David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Joining us this afternoon is no stranger to our airwaves. We know him. We love him. He has his own show, The Collision, the intersection between sports and politics. It's Dave Zirin, who we know and love. This man is prolific. He has like 20,000 books, but this one is probably, to me, man, it's a banger, The Kaepernick Effect. And when I picked it up, I thought it was just going to be about Colin Kaepernick. And you definitely, you know, go through what Colin started with the kneeling and his protests. But then you give a breakdown of what went around this country. And I'll just say after, well, I listened to the audiobook. It's riveting. It's compelling. There's a hell of a lot of stuff I didn't know. It's inspiring, especially the sections about the high school kids, the sacrifices that people made that you detail needs to be heralded. It needs to be uplifted. And it's scary. It's scary to see the depth of racism in this country. And I think that is very sobering. So let's talk about the impetus for this book. You know, I'm kind of alluding to it, but I'm going to let you start breaking this down for us.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, David, I agree with everything that you just said. Well, you know, and I'm not putting that on myself or gassing myself up, but I think the stories are riveting. The courage displayed by these young people is incredibly energizing. It can make you feel optimistic, and it also can be very scary, like you said. The fact that all these young people took a knee and people's response was not, hey, let me hear what you have to say, or gee, let's just disagree without being disagreeable, but that their response to this act of nonviolent civil disobedience was violence. And the threat of violence or the actuality of violence. I just think it says something about this country that's very real and that we see more of every day. But I'll tell you, the impetus, which is what you asked about for this book, it actually started with a conversation with somebody you know very well, Dr. John Carlos, a 1968 Olympian who raised his fist on the medal stand in Mexico City. Great guy.
You wrote a book about.
Yes, John's memoir we wrote together, and so we've just been tight like that, you know, because, you know, you write a book with someone, it's certainly a bonding experience. And I was talking with John a few years ago, and he made this offhand comment to me that where he said, you know, after we raised our fists in 1968, you know, a lot of young people started doing it at track meets and athletic events around the country. And I was like, what? I didn't know that. I thought I knew everything about 1968, you know, having done this book with you. I didn't know that it turned into this like youth movement. Like, who were these people? What happened to them? What repercussions did they face in their own lives when that fist hit the air? And I realized I would never really know the answer to that question, but you know, it's been over 50 years, but it really made me think about these sort of one-off stories that I had written and that other people had written for, of course, about people who'd taken a knee after Kaepernick took a knee. And I was like, I need to explore this because I may have written an article here about a football team where people threw garbage at them for taking a knee, or write an article there about a cheerleader who felt forced out of her school. But we need to look at this holistically. We need to look at this as what I believe it was, which is a national movement involving hundreds, if not thousands, of athletes after Kaepernick took that knee. So I was like, I need to figure out these stories and accompany them so they don't get forgotten the same way the people who raised their fist in 1968 have been forgotten. And so I put the book together, and this to me was reason enough to do the book, was just to compile these stories. And I started working on it at the start of the pandemic. But then, you know, summer of 2020 happens, and we get the largest protests in the history of the United States after the police murder of George Floyd. And I went back and I called all the people that I'd interviewed just to find out where their heads were at with all of this. And I found that every single one was either in the streets or organizing people to get in the streets. And, you know, that made me realize that while many roads may have led us to the summer of 2020, one of them runs through the athletic fields of the United States. And that, to me, was a very important story to tell.
You captured this just brilliantly. You know, just on a side note, it's funny because, you know, when Jeff Chang and myself, when we did Can't Stop, Won't Stop, it was supposed to be published, you know, in March of, 2020. And of course, you know, the pandemic hit. So it was delayed a couple of months. And then George Floyd happened and we pulled the levers. And it was just amazing because we had to go back and deal with a whole lot. We had to rewrite so much because it was just such a momentous occasion and we couldn't afford to miss that part of history. So it's just interesting to hear what you're saying, like you were ready to do your thing and then George Floyd happens, but the book wouldn't be the same without the backdrop of George Floyd, because you can see as you're reading it or listening to it that you're talking to these people and you're in the moment of when they were doing these things. And then George Floyd happens. And now, you know, it's like, let's fast forward 4 years later.
Yeah. How are you doing now? What are you thinking? What are you doing?
So let me start off with the high school. You have the book divided up in. Well, let's just start with Kaepernick first. What did you capture with Colin Kaepernick that people may have overlooked? What stood out for me was the sacrifice that he made. I think that gets overshadowed, and I don't think there's a full appreciation for the sacrifice that he made. You know, but tell me what you pulled out of that and what you want people to really kind of ponder over.
Well, I certainly agree with you about that. And that would have been a very appropriate answer of something that I think has been glossed over. But, you know, to be honest about the first thing that came to my head when you asked that question was, I don't think people get how spontaneous and incidental this entire thing was. I don't think people understand that when Colin Kaepernick first sat during the anthem and he didn't take a knee. This wasn't done with a press release. This wasn't done with a master plan. This wasn't done with even a tweet. That this was something that was done out of a genuine sense of disgust about the police murders that had taken place over the summer of 2016. Alton Sterling, Philando Castile being the ones that were videotaped and went very public. And so Colin Kaepernick makes this decision just to sit during the anthem, feeling that same sense of disgust that I think many people were feeling around the country during that summer of protest. And so it's a preseason game, so it's in August. So it's still in that summer. It's still in that mode. It's still in that mood. And if a reporter named Steve Weish, who I interviewed for the book, had not seen Colin sit, and made a beeline for him because he'd known Colin since college and built up rapport and trust, this might have been a 1 week thing. Like, we might have never known this had happened. There would have been no knee, there would have been no movement, there would have been no athletes. I mean, it really happened out of something that was innocuous. So, and I think that's the thing people don't realize, is that there was no master plan here, that a lot of this was ad-libbed brilliantly, I would argue, by Colin and friends as the months went on in 2016.
Was this, it sounds like in the book, that really what spurned this was Colin's answer to Steve Weiss's question.
Yes.
More than it was, because it just sounded like Colin, as you described, was coming of political age, if we can use. He's taking these classes at Cal. He's starting to soak in this information. He's getting quote unquote woke, and he just decided, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit down. But it seems like his answer to Steve's question is what sets this off.
Yeah, he said, there are bodies in the streets and police are getting away with murder. And what I say about him ad-libbing brilliantly, what I mean by that, I want to be clear, is, you know, so he causes this uproar, and then, you know, the right wing and Trump are saying, well, he's doing this against the troops, he's doing this to spit on the flag and the country. So Colin Kaepernick, he goes into this conversation with Nate Boyer, former NFL player in Green Beret, and they came up with this idea to do the knee because they felt like it would be seen as more respectful towards the anthem and something that showcases civil disobedience while also showcasing at least respect for the ritual. And I think, you know, their calculations were off by a million miles because they thought that would calm people down. But all it really did was raise the flames dramatically, because there's something about taking that knee that I think sets off right wingers like nobody's business, like that gesture of taking the knee. And we could debate and discuss why that is. What is it about the knee that makes them so crazy? And sure enough, when I interviewed people for the book, several people, young people, had stories about going to take a knee in college or high school, and basically like their school administrators got so fearful, they're like ready to print them up Black Lives Matter t-shirts and say, wear these instead. Or right, they show right up at the locker room with black sashes and say, wear these on your uniforms instead. Just please, anything but taking that knee, please.
Well, let me ask you this, Dave. We're talking with Dave Zirin, talking about his new book, The Kaepernick Effect, if you're just tuning in. Well, there's a few questions I have, but let's go back. Kaepernick is sitting on his bench. He's not standing up for the national anthem. Lots of people, believe it or not, sit on a bench and don't stand. Marshawn Lynch is one prime one. He never, ever stood. So it sounds like, this is why I come back, it sounds like his response to a reporter asking a question is what sets it off, because, you know, lots of people have always sat and just didn't stand. I'm just curious as to how his answer to a simple question sparked this national attention. You talked about him taking a knee after conferring with Nate, the Green Beret, who suggested he did it was a miscalculation in terms of response. But it sounds like to me, it was also a miscalculation of the people who tried to use Colin's answer as a football to kind of bury and discredit
exactly
the protest that was going on prior to him doing this around police brutality. So it said, let's take this athlete and drag him through the mud. And Colin had a response, and that's what set it off, because I wonder what would have happened if they had talked to Marshawn or any of these other people, what the trajectory would have been, where, you know, you knew that you wouldn't be able to rattle him. I think they thought they could rattle Colin.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
Yeah. They were operating from an old playbook, you know, that was used against people like Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who didn't come out for the anthem in the 90s. You know, they think that if they can, you know, just sort of crank up the right wing noise machine, create an atmosphere of tension and intimidation, that next thing you know, and this was offered to Colin Kaepernick, next thing you know, he would be on 60 Minutes with Tony Dungy sitting next to him, who's like the elder black coach who's often brought out to, you know, say to a white audience, don't worry, this guy's okay. You know, he's the person you can trust. And he just maybe made a few mistakes along the way. You know, that's what Tony Dungy did with Michael Vick and many other people over the years. And Colin Kaepernick was having none of it. You know, it actually reminds me a lot of when Muhammad Ali said he was not going to fight in Vietnam. And while he was being excoriated by the right-wing media and the mainstream media and the liberal media, he also was given back channel opportunities to take it all back and say, you know, just join the USO. No one's going to send you with a rifle to Southeast Asia. Just, you know, box with some red, white, and blue trunks and everything's going to be okay. You know, like Joe Louis did. And Muhammad Ali wasn't having it. And Colin Kaepernick wasn't having it. And the thing that bonds Ali and Kaepernick, something that Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf did not have, was the presence of a movement. So if you're, that's so critical, because Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf was like lonely man on an island in the mid 90s, you know, trying to take this stand. And when he got dumped on by the press and by teammates and by local radio, He found himself in a position where there were no avenues towards anything. And Colin Kaepernick found himself in a situation where there were people in the streets and people on social media saying, "You go, Colin. You know, we support you." And certainly the Bay Area, I think it benefited him greatly that he happened to be playing in the Bay. Where, I mean, imagine if he'd been playing in Buffalo or something like that. You know, right. I mean, it was a very different set of material circumstances around Colin that I think made a big difference and gave him the confidence to take that one day of sitting and then maybe that one week of taking a knee and turning it into a 4-month protest spectacle while also playing a very high level of football.
Right.
I remember one other John Carlos discussion is one time John Carlos, I remember this happened in 2017. John Carlos looked at me and he just said, "You know, I raised that fist in Mexico City. I did it for about a minute and a half and, you know, that stayed with me forever." Colin Kaepernick basically did what I did, except he's been doing it for 4 straight months. Mm. So you think about that level of intensity, that level of pressure to actually enact this protest week in, week out, deal with the road media whenever you're there. And, you know, this was a really impressive journey that he went on in 2016. And the great gift that he gave to this young generation of athletes, and I write this in the book, is like, not like some heroic inspiration as in like, oh, he's their new hero and he's doing it because they're doing it because of him and it's some sort of idol worship copycat thing. No, what he gave these young athletes, what he bequeathed to them was a method of protest, was a language of protest that as an athlete you could learn very quickly and then enact where you were and then be part of a chain and part of a movement. And that knee is this great gift that, you know, even if today, Davey, if you and I went to the Super Bowl or you and I went to a state fair in Iowa and we decided to take a knee during the anthem, everybody would know what was going on
right. Immediately.
And that's Colin's gift.
So in the book, we're talking with Dave Zirin, if you're just tuning in. What you talk about with Colin, his sacrifice, what he was up against, what he was weighing, the huge amount of money that he lost, and the high caliber football that he was playing, because there was a lot of gaslighting that was going on that said that he was not a good thing, you know, and they would find Uncle Tom type of individuals like a Jason Whitlock that would say, oh, he's not good. But then stat after stat after stat was showing that he was a high level when he started starting for the Niners. And to compliment your book, I was down at the 49er headquarters and I interviewed some of those executives, including Harry Edwards, among others. And they made the point, you know, we have the interview right here where he said, I just want to make sure that everybody is clear that his level of play was stellar. And they read off the statistics at the 49er stadium, you know, just to say, like, this is what's going on. So don't get it twisted. But with that being said, that in itself is brilliant and worth reading. But man, the thing that, and I say this very sincerely, what will move you to tears is the chapters that come afterwards. Especially you start off with, you divide it into high school, college, and professional. The stories of the high schoolers. Oh my gosh. I have 3 full pages of notes. You know, I don't take notes.
Nah, when I'm reading.
I don't do that, but I'm going, what captures it is that all these people who are doing a black woman here, young black kid here, in the middle of these oftentimes very hostile places, they're the only ones taking knees, and the vitriol that they were receiving, I mean, it is just, and the thoughtfulness as to why they were doing. I think the one thing that stood out was probably your first story with Rodney out of Brunswick, Ohio. This is like one of the first stories. And he's like, look, I'm doing this because, you know, my teammates, they use the N-word, his white teammates, referring to rival schools. And then they turn to him and say, you're not one of them, you're different. And that sets it off. So let's explain this, because you capture the isolation, the fear that their parents had, and the overt damn violence. There was violence directed at these high school kids who, man, people got to read that alone. You could have just did a book on the high school kids themselves. I hope you do a movie on it.
Man, you know what makes me happy is, you know, the proceeds from the book, Davey, my proceeds are going to an organization called Serve Your City, which is a mutual aid group in D.C. that works with kids. And one of the things that Serve Your City did, I didn't ask them to do this, but once we made this deal to do this, they went out and bought 500 copies of the book wholesale and put one in each of 500 backpacks, along with back to school items.
Yeah.
And that to me was what it's all about, because it's about paying forward the courage of these young people, not personally profiting from it, you know, because that would be kind of weird if, you know, they did all this courage and I was like, yeah, I'm getting paid writing about this courage. You know, I didn't want that. So I'm paying it forward. But I raise that just to say that, like, these young people are next level, and they leave you feeling very optimistic. And the optimism, unfortunately, I wish the optimism come from the fact that this was like some Disney story and they took a knee and the community rallied around them and said, we're going to be an anti-racist space. And we've learned because Rodney Axon Jr. showed us the way. And that's not the case at all. But what's inspiring is that these young people like Rodney, they have no regrets about what they did. You know, they feel so strongly that it was the right thing to do. And that if it did provoke hate, if Rodney had to walk his little sister to elementary school because of the death threats that his family was getting, I mean, that to him is just part of the price that you pay for being part of the struggle and for exposing white supremacy. And that to me was really inspiring, because, you know, there's a stereotype about young people, people like my daughter's age who are 17, that they're somehow soft, you know, that they're somehow coddled. And the young people I spoke with, and I'll include my daughter in this too, even though she's not in the book, but they're tough as a $2 steak, you know, because they've been through stuff that people my age just can't imagine. And I'm talking about generational stuff, like, you know, living in a permanent state of war, you know, post 9/11, your entire life, not knowing what life was like before that, pandemics, police violence that gets videotaped and goes viral, like all the things that are on their shoulders. I didn't even say anything about the environment and existential fears about the future. You know, in the midst of all that, they're fighting for a better world because they realize this one is utterly inappropriate for human living. So
I think
that just is deep to me.
I think what captures me, and we're still talking about just one of the many stories that you bring forth, Rodney out of Brunswick, Ohio. And I hope people understood, first of all, that when this thing came up, he was racially aware because of his teammates using the N-word and saying he's not, you know, he's different. He's the nice black kid. So there was a consciousness about that. There was no discipline or no pushing back or no shutting that whole thing down from the coaches on down, which I thought was just, you know, which, you know, it's like, this is just normal. But the threats, like you said, like he was concerned that people were going to find out who his sister was, who was in elementary school, and what would happen to her. And eventually, as you said, he had to walk her to school. He had the death threats, but he was also finding out more about history in America, like Francis Scott Key's words to the national anthem. So it became different than Colin Kaepernick. He was the inspiration, but these folks that you got had their own crosses to bear.
Yes.
And it was just amazing. The other one that stood out was the team out of Beaumont. Can we talk a little bit about them? Because the NFL did step in. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, some NFL players stepped in.
Yeah, NFL players,
On their own, because, you know, the NFL wasn't going to touch this with a 10-foot pole. But these young kids, Beaumont, Texas, you know, which is a place that borders the Klan in Texas. It borders what's still known as a sundown town. And people in Beaumont will tell you not this town, or be very careful that the sun's not setting when you're in your car, because you will get pulled over. You will, it's just something that someone more sheltered would think comes out of the 1950s, or, you know, it's like from Lovecraft country or something. Yeah. When this is reality of life in 2021 in this part of Texas. And yet still, you know, these middle schoolers in Beaumont were old enough to realize what was happening in the world through some of these viral videos of people being killed by police. And yet young enough to really ask the question, why does the world have to be this way? So they're really at that perfect middle school age where you're socially aware, but still, you know, very innocent and naive about, you know, wait a minute, like, why does the world, you know, have to be like this? You know, no cynicism. And so they decided, you know, after talking to their coach, that they were going to take a knee. They got support from their parents, who were very socially minded people. And the response, I mean, this is what's so wild to me, because people always joke that in Texas, you know, it goes God and football and family, and not necessarily in that order. Mm-hmm. And yet here's the thing, is that this story exposes that it's not just about God, football, and family. It's about white supremacy. And so rather than have these young people play football, they canceled the team and canceled the league, rather than have kids who took a knee. I mean, how wild is that? That in Texas,
these are middle school kids.
These are middle school kids.
Not high school. Middle school. 12, 13, 11.
And it's so wild to me that like I used to joke this when I wrote a book about Brazil, and there were these huge protests in Brazil when they were building all those stadiums for the World Cup. I used to joke, like, how messed up does a situation have to be if you've got Brazilians protesting soccer? You know, that's like New Yorkers protesting pizza, for goodness sakes. And how messed up does Texas have to have them cancel football because they're so freaked out about people taking a knee? You got Texas canceling football. And, you know, this could have been on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Texas cancels football team and football league because they're so freaked out about any challenge to racism and racial mores and racial hierarchies. And the kids were absolutely bereft. I mean, my goodness. I mean, to take sports away from them, to take football away from them, it was a very, very sad moment. And several NFL players, like Anquan Boldin being one of them, stepped in when they heard about this story. This is one of the great justifications for social media. Does so much bad in this world, but I'll give props to social media for this story, because if this happened in a different time, who would have heard about a middle school team in Beaumont, Texas? Right. Would have made the local papers, if that. But this story got out there into the social media ecosphere. And Anquan Boldin picked it up and wrote checks to start a new league down there. And now the kids have football again, and they get to play and see each other and do all those things. We could probably have a separate discussion about whether youth football is healthy or whether kids should wait till they're 14, but this is Texas we're talking about. So
they have their own league, like kind of similar to what Snoop did with his kids. And
yes.
Right. So it's their own league. They control it. Can't shut it down. Can't pull the money. These NFL players like Anquan Boldin and others, like,
and they've incorporated, like, they're making sure that the league has much more of an educational component, so it's transformative for the kids. So it's like, you know, it's tied to grades and tied to reading, and, you know, it's really using sports as a way to help grow these kids up, which the first league was not like at all. It was just mercenary, you know, go out there and play some football.
You know, Dave Zirin, there are so many stories here. And what I'm seeing throughout these different stories that you describe, and this is just the first chapter on the high school, coaches lost their job for supporting the kids. People had to move to other cities because of the threats. There's the big fight, you know, brawl that takes place in Detroit between Jebny and Allmont. You can see that online. And, you know, the vitriol that is over and over again being levied on these folks. But I think what I hope people can capture is that in many of these places, it's one or two people, three or four people that do this, and they catch the wrath of God, over and over again. And I also want people to, you can also describe people like, I'm probably not going to get recruited to a college.
Yeah.
I'm going to sacrifice my scholarship to go to a school. That is on the line with the pressure from the school to say, if it's a private school, donors pulling out money and all this weight being put on a 16-year-old saying you're causing donors to pull out money. You got to do a different type of protest. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that I found to be inspiring that they stood their ground. Troubling to see adults smash on kids the way that they did, pulling out all the stops.
I mean, the reason why I've had people ask me the question, Davey, like, do you think you should have divided the book by sports, or do you think you should have divided the book by gender, or do you think you should have divided the book in any other way? And to me, though, high school, college, and pro was the only thing that made sense, because they're a very specific set of challenges and circumstances, whether you're a high school student, college, or a professional. And the collegiate level, it's its own animal, and it demands its own examination. Because you're dealing with boosters, you're dealing with scholarships that can be rescinded on an annual basis, and you're putting yourself out there to possibly lose your education for the purposes of making this larger point and using the athletic field as a platform to do that. And this is also where you see like these very, very skittish admissions officials. And college presidents even, who are, I mean, that's the crazy thing is like, you've got an 18-year-old cheerleader who takes a knee in Iowa. And next thing you know, she's sitting across a desk with a school president who's absolutely freaking out because he's worried about, he doesn't care about racism or racial inequity. I mean, he cares about donors and what's going to happen if they see that some person on the cheerleading squad is taking a knee. It's just amazing. Like, it just says something about two things to me. Like, one, just how frail so much of the power structure in this country is if they're that freaked out over something like this, and just how aware they are also that the backlash that could come would be like a tsunami that could take down an entire school or an entire department. I mean, there's no sense of proportion of what you think it would be, which is, oh, this person took a knee. They clearly have some things they want to share. Let's create forums and discussions and figure out, how to, use this as an educational opportunity. No, instead it's, oh my gosh, this is going to unleash violence. This is going to unleash financial disturbances. And that collegiate context where there's this constant level of near hysteria is something that's very much so bizarre, I have to say, because this isn't like this in other places in the world. It's very much a U.S. thing, because sports at a U.S. college is like a financial tentpole, right, for the modern university. And it's lost all sense of proportion relative to what an educational mission of a school should be. And that's what causes like this act to become something where people freak out that it could potentially be like, a game of Jenga where you pull out the wrong piece and it all comes tumbling down.
If you're just tuning in, we've been talking with Dave Zirin. You hear him on our sister station out in DC. You hear him actually here on our home station here, KPFA. You also read many of his books, and his newest book is The Kaepernick Effect. That's what we're talking about this afternoon. Let me ask you this, Dave. We've been talking about the reaction to people taking a knee. But let's kind of put this in a different context. We've all been to games. I've been to many a tailgate, many a sporting events, football, basketball, what have you. When the national anthem comes on, people are like, let's go to the bathroom. Let's go get our popcorn. Definitely when I've been at tailgates, I've never seen everybody stop and go, now's the time for us to turn down the music, put down the beer, and say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I bring this up to give it context, because you would think that the flag and the Pledge of Allegiance and the national anthem were so sacred that everything ceases when it is said, which would be understandable when people said, well, I'm just offended. But they're not. This seems like something else is happening. Is this just about Black people standing up for themselves? Is this about, you know, anti-Blackness and using the flag, wrapping yourself around the flag and the anthem, and, you know, as a pretext, or is there something else at play?
No, I mean, I think I've always thought that the white wing should be complimenting Colin Kaepernick for actually bringing solemnity to the national anthem and turning it into the actual political reckoning that it should be. I mean, every time that anthem plays, people should think about the gap between what this country says it represents and the lived realities of the poor, of people who are Black and brown, of people who are marginalized. You know, that should be what the conversation is about. And that's the conversation Colin Kaepernick brought to the table. And so the rage, it is about anti-Blackness. It is about challenging the fantasy that a lot of people choose to live under about what this country is, about who the founding fathers were, about what their aspirations were. And, you know, it's, to me, the whole controversy around Colin Kaepernick was really a canary in the coal mine for everything we're seeing right now around so-called critical race theory. Right. And which let's be honest, like it's that the whole critical race theory is really about, will we teach systemic racism or won't we to our children?
Right. Do you think the Kaepernick effect is the awakening of all these people that you detail throughout the book? From the college level to middle school, seeing all these people who were inspired by Colin, not just to take a knee. And I want to emphasize that you spell that out clearly in the book. These folks are not just taking a knee, but they're very thoughtful. They're like, you know what? Let's challenge the ideals. And how many people are impacted by police terrorism? That's the other thing that strikes me, is the fear, the visceral reaction to it. So I bring all this up to say that it seems like that awakening from the Kaepernick effect becomes the acceleration of, let's just shut down all this ethnic studies, race consciousness. Let's not have this in schools. Let's pass laws so we can't even talk about it no more. That's what this seems like.
Yes and yes. The Kaepernick effect is about awakening to the reality of police violence. It's about awakening to the reality of institutionalized racism. The Kaepernick effect is also about the revealing of how much viciousness there is in racist white America. You know, there is no, you read these stories and you see there is no agreeing to disagree. There is no, gee, you're making a good point, but I let's have a bigger discussion about it. In 99% of these stories, it's, oh, you're making me think about things I don't want to think about. Therefore, I'm going to respond with the threats or the actuality of violence.
Yeah. The other thing
says something about this country.
The other thing, too, the reason why I asked you about the flag, if this was really about the anthem and the flag, in several of the stories, in particular, the one in Schenectady, where you document Ishmael, I guess his name is Ishmael.
Yeah.
And then you have the sister, Nala Williams, out of Iowa, right? Mm-hmm. Who actually gets called out by David Duke, you know, and she gets threatened on that level. People, you all got to read this. It's just unbelievable. But in those instances, while people are taking the knee, these folks are hurling the Confederate flag. So that's why I was asking that question. This is not about the anthem, because you all are sitting up, these folks are waving the Confederate flag.
Yeah.
How do you even have a Confederate flag at a game in the first place? Is the first question.
especially if the game is in upstate New York. I mean, give me a break. We're not exactly talking about the old Confederacy, which just, you know, again, proves that Confederate flag is a symbol of white supremacy and violence and oppression. It has nothing to do with Southern pride or whatever BS they're putting out there. And so that's part of the Kaepernick effect too, is like really, really showing that the emperor has no clothes. And revealing some very sharp realities about this country. And another thing about the Kaepernick effect is that it's also spurred all kinds of, I would argue, all kinds of reforms over the last 5 years that are very piecemeal and very thin, but sort of revealed how scared the powers that be were of this awakening in the world of sports. So, for example, you don't see the Washington football team name change without Colin Kaepernick taking that knee. You don't. You don't see the name, image, and likeness reforms in NCAA sports without Colin Kaepernick taking that knee. Because there's this fear of a kind of restiveness, of a kind of that these players just aren't going to take it anymore, that they're fed up. And Colin Kaepernick represents the breakdown of authority, the breakdown of the very authoritarian vertical structure that exists in football and exists in all sports, but particularly football. And the powers that be have responded with fear, with carrot and stick. Like, the stick is, of course, you ban Colin Kaepernick, you kick kids off of teams, you do all kinds of things like that. But then you also offer up like putting end racism in the end zone or writing Black Lives Matter on the court. Like, all of these things are linked together, and we need to be able to see that.
You know, I know time is short, so let me just get the last couple in, Dave Zirin. One of the critiques of Colin is that he's been silent. No press conferences, no quotes. Every once in a while, he'll do a tweet. I think the last time most people really heard him speak in public was when he had the tryout, and he said, you know, and he didn't really take questions. He just said, tell the NFL to stop being scared. And we haven't heard him. We haven't seen him sit down and give his analysis on things. And in the most part, he's disappeared. Now, some people could say, you know, that gave room for other people to have their own interpretation. Others were saying, well, you took this leadership stance and then you just left. So are we still boycotting the NFL? Is that still on? Colin, what are we doing? Are you trying to get your job back? You know, what's the deal? So is there a critique of Colin, or did Colin handle this correctly?
It's interesting. Like, I don't really have any sort of, and I don't think I really can sort of be in judgment of whether it was handled correctly or incorrectly. I do think that his strategy to choose silence has had several beneficial effects. So whatever negatives could come from silence, and of course there are negatives that come from silence, the positive is that people sort of get to pick up the baton from what he did and move forward and not feel burdened by whatever he might be saying that week or that month. Like, imagine if Colin, and I'm not saying he does, but imagine if he had strong opinions about the state of Israel or vaccines or things like that. Immediately taking that knee would mean supporting maybe ideas that you don't know about or are unsure about, or the media has you thinking, you know, three different ways about. Like, the purity to what he did that allows others to emulate it and take it forward. And that's where the power of silence really does come in. And I see it as a very deliberate act. I think Colin, he's a very smart dude. He's also a very soft-spoken dude. So I think this posture is something that I'm sure he's justified to himself and that he's also very comfortable with. I'll tell you what's gonna be interesting, Davey, is, and I don't have an answer for this, is that we're going to be seeing a lot of Colin in the next year. Like, he's got this Ava DuVernay special coming out. He's got a children's book about his life that's coming out. He's got another book coming out about his thoughts about abolitionism. And it's going to be curious to see if there is an audience after 5 years for his biography, for his personal story. Because one of the things that I find so compelling about the people that I interviewed for the Kaepernick Effect is that they weren't particularly interested in his biography or his story or his particular narrative. What they were interested in doing was fighting back against police violence. And in Colin, they saw a method for doing that. And that's why they view him as a heroic figure. Not so much because he grew up adopted in Wisconsin, in a particular home, and was largely unknown going into college. Like, these biographical details are really secondary, and it'll be interesting to see what I feel like is going to happen is that, particularly in the Ava DuVernay show, is that there's going to be an effort to look at his upbringing as a way to draw political conclusions from that about America, and that's a very difficult needle to thread.
Yeah.
I mean, because like, I mean, think about like, if you, Davey D, were handed, $50 million and Ava DuVernay's help, would you do it to talk about the world and politics and what you wanted to see change? Or would you do it to tell the story of your life?
Right.
I would do the first. And I'm pretty sure you would do the first as well.
Yeah.
Colin is doing the second. Will that be successful? I don't have an answer to that. But I'll tell you, I'm very curious to find out.
Yeah, because what happens when it becomes about you, then it's easy to get canceled,
yes.
Or the amplification of somebody who has a critique. That's what will happen. And then it becomes, Colin had white parents, or, Colin didn't join the BSU. People start to nitpick. Here, it's been hard to do that except to say he's been quiet. He'd pop up here and there. And I think the only other besmirching was that he didn't, he said he didn't vote, mm-hmm. And people ran with that to the bank and tried to use that as a reason to cancel, which is why I think this book is so powerful, because you have all these stories of people that carried this baton, and they carried it every which way. We haven't even talked about what happened in the pro. That's the last chapter. Yeah, the football. Yeah, that's a whole other, thing.
Davey, what you're talking about is, some people have asked me, this just goes with this, is said to me, hey, this book is different than other books you've written because I don't really hear your voice in it as much as in the other books. And that was very, very, very on purpose. Because, it's part of navigating that silence from Colin. Because then you have to think to yourself, okay, there's a vacuum in terms of the voices for what this has been all about, the taking of the knee and protesting during the anthem and raising awareness about police violence and then the 2020 protests. There's a vacuum there. And so whose voice should fill that vacuum? I truly believe that the most appropriate voices to fill that vacuum are the people who dared to put these ideas into practice.
Yeah.
So it's not about centering my voice. It's about centering their voices because they've earned that.
Yeah. Dave, I want to thank you for talking with us this afternoon. This is an incredible book. For people who read it, you cross the gauntlet. I mean, you're showing people who are from all different backgrounds, black, mm-hmm. white, Latino, immigrants, mm-hmm. who taken its knee and the battles that they've gone. You have a lot of examples of women. I think I'm inspired by the women that are bold because two things that stand out is that they were unrelenting, oftentimes by themselves, mm-hmm. and the violence that was directed at them. Yo, folks, when I talk, I mean, that's what's sobering. It's like you're getting somebody who is 17 years old, 18 maybe, who's saying, I'm gonna take a knee. I think the one sister quit her team, and because she got all that pressure from the university, she quit her team or the cheerleading squad, but still showed up at the games to take a knee in the stands by herself and had to have, and was being met with violence. That to me is something straight out of the 1950s. And those stories, I'm glad you documented them, got them out, because those are things that mainstream pretty much ignored.
Yeah.
I mean, it's completely ignored, it's silenced. And I think if people saw that, like, wait a second, they're attacking a woman who quit the team, who said, I don't need to do this anymore. I'm going to sacrifice that career and I'm going to go into the stands anyway, because it's about principle. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And they still come after her.
Exactly. No, well put. That's what it's all about. It's about principle in the face of violence.
Real talk.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, you know, last question, because it's about the folks, and I didn't really get a chance to dwell too deep into the pros, right? Mm-hmm. So you have professional football where the knee sparked off, but you actually have the basketball, the NBA, where people are very outspoken. And in some ways with LeBron and others, there's an activist bent there. I don't know how it is with Major League Baseball. We've seen it in some parts of soccer, but how do you see the world of sports right now, the reaction in the face of all these challenges, police terror, you know, income inequality, et cetera, et cetera? Have these athletes stepped up, and are they on those levels of the John Carlos's or Muhammad Ali's? Have they blazed a different path, or do they still have a long way to go?
No, I think they've blazed a path that we're going to be talking about for decades. Things might seem a little quiet right now, but some of that has to do with coverage. Like, there are high school students still taking a knee. There are little league teams still taking knees. I get, and still facing retribution. I could have spent another year on this book just with latest developments. I mean, I get emails all the time from folks. So people shouldn't be fooled. You know, there's just, you know, everybody's, you know, it's like a cat following a laser pointer. You know, we're all just looking at whatever the media says as the latest big story to look at. But this movement in sports is ongoing, and the wine is out of the bottle. I don't think you're ever going to be able to tell an athlete again that politics are not a part of their lives.
The other thing, and last thing for real, is what seems different than in the past. And I just know this personally, maybe you can share what you know. A lot of these athletes, they might not speak, but they've been putting money. They've been like, let me fund your organization. Yeah. How much y'all need? I got you. You know, mm-hmm. Don't put my name in it because I need this money from X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are kind of taking the Harry Belafonte approach and making sure that, you know, y'all, you know, keep doing what you're doing. I'm going to bail you out, or I'm going to make sure you have your operating budget. Can we talk about that? Because that, I don't know if you mentioned that in the end, but to me, that's been the most inspiring of just seeing how these athletes have been getting down.
No, that's right. You know, and I a couple examples in the book, but yeah, like, but the a lot of that is done under wraps. But, you know, I can just tell you from what I've heard on the grapevine is that there's a realization among athletes that they can do things that someone like John Carlos or even someone like Ali did not have the financial ability to do, which is not only provide political support or ideological support, but they could provide material support for this young generation that's shaking the world.
Real talk. Dave Zirin, job well done.
Thank
the name
you,
of the book, Kaepernick Effect. You can catch Dave and Etan Thomas here on KPFA. It is called The Collision, the intersection between sports and politics. But this book, man, you put your foot in this book.
Thank you.
People put their foot in this book. So thank you. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.